It's National Mental Health Awareness Month. Over the past few decades, research shows that stigma towards some common mental illnesses like depression and anxiety disorders has decreased drastically. But people who have mental illnesses that cause psychosis, things like schizophrenia, are rarely included in the conversation. People with psychotic symptoms like hallucinations or delusions can still face stereotyping and discrimination. A 2013 study from the National Institutes of Health found more negative stereotypes and less willingness to help for people labeled as at risk for schizophrenia than for non-psychotic mental health disorders like depression and anxiety. We're learning about psychosis and why it still carries that stigma, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one experienced one of the different kinds of psychosis? What were your interactions with medical and psychiatric care like? What do you think people get wrong about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Raquel Meshulam-Gately is an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School and a licensed clinical psychologist. She's director of neuropsychology research and the Consumer Advisory Board at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Raquel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me to join your show. I'm really delighted to be here. And I just want to note that I am especially honored to be included in the show with your next guest, Cindy Hodge from the Wildflower Alliance. I know that their work was just featured in a New York Times Magazine article last week, and I am so impressed with the incredibly important and valuable work that they do.
Now, I just mentioned the word psychosis a couple times. Can you give us kind of a working definition for our conversation? What do we mean by psychosis?
Sure. Well, first, let me say that psychosis is a set of symptoms, not a diagnosis. So it is not the same thing as a diagnosis like schizophrenia, although schizophrenia is one of several conditions in which psychotic symptoms are a primary feature. So psychosis is a set of symptoms referring to a loss of contact with reality or difficulty telling what's real from what is not. The symptoms can also make it harder for a person to think clearly, to communicate, relate to others, and to feel emotions. A person can experience psychosis for numerous reasons, such as in the context of drug use, medical issues like seizures or sleep deprivation, postpartum, traumatic stress, grief, medical treatments, dementia, or a psychiatric condition such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or depression. So when someone seeks help for psychotic symptoms, so many factors are considered, such as their specific symptoms, when they started, the severity, extent of distress and impact, and the potential causes and influences. And I'll also note that psychosis is a lot more common than people tend to think. Symptoms fall on a continuum based on severity, frequency, and impact, just like depression and anxiety or any other condition for that matter. And we all fall somewhere on the spectrum, which can fluctuate over time or in different circumstances. I think we can all think of times when maybe because we didn't sleep well, we were under the influence of a substance, we experienced a lot of stress one day, or a variety of other reasons, we may have noticed that our thoughts or perceptions weren't as clear as they typically are. So because of that, we often avoid using the terms normal or abnormal, but rather familiar versus distressing. And just one last important point I want to make is that early intervention can really help to promote recovery and reduce disability. We know that treatment delays often lead to poorer outcomes. And there's now more help than ever for people experiencing signs of serious mental illnesses. Early recognition and intervention can make a real difference for people.
I want to get to that stigma issue. I got to say, in the popular culture landscape I grew up in, if I saw, say, a TV show or movie with somebody identified with schizophrenia or hearing voices, it was a comedy. It was played for laughs. It wasn't a comedy. The person was portrayed as very dangerous. And that's what I grew up knowing, quote unquote, about these conditions. Can you talk about the damage that might do?
Absolutely. And you're right. There has long been an association between schizophrenia and dangerousness, as well as a lot of other negative misperceptions and misunderstandings about the conditions. And those attitudes really negatively impact upon the lives of people living with the condition. They're linked to less social interaction, lower levels of recovery and vocational functioning and quality of life. Plus, because of that stigma, people who have the condition aren't willing to talk about it as much. They aren't willing to seek out care for it as frequently. Their family members by association also will feel shame and often won't seek out care for their loved ones. And sometimes clinicians are not willing to disclose a diagnosis of psychosis to patients or schizophrenia because of that negative association with it. So it can do a lot of damage. And I think even the term just over time has been so abused in the media and just in our day-to-day language. I mean, it's often used as an adjective to describe any kind of erratic behavior, you know, whether it be referring to the government, financial market, sports. I mean, the list can go on and on. So I think that's really confused people about what schizophrenia is.
We're talking to Raquel Meshulam-Gately from Harvard Medical School, looking at some of the different conditions that cause psychosis, schizophrenia included in that, and other psychological conditions. You can join in if you have a story you'd be willing to share at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Raquel, you mentioned the value of early treatment. So suppose somebody recognizes this in themselves or a family member, overcomes that stigma, goes to seek treatment, gets a clinician who's ready to work with them. What kind of things are out there that can help?
Right. Well, we know the best kind of treatments out there, especially for the early phases of psychosis, are coordinated specialty care models. And there's, I'll just speak of Massachusetts, there's numerous clinics available here where they offer a variety of services, not just medication, but different types of psychosocial interventions. Peer support is often included, family-based treatments. So it's a really integrated, comprehensive approach to trying to help with those early symptoms of psychosis. And we do know, again, that the earlier you intervene in these conditions, the better the outcomes are. So we really encourage that. And I'll just say, too, that I'm involved with an initiative within Massachusetts called the Massachusetts Psychosis Network for Early Treatment. And within that, we provide training and technical assistance to providers across the state to really try to link them up with the best practices and models for helping people with psychosis.
Now, for someone who is interacting with someone, maybe a loved one, maybe a patient, and that loved one or patient says, "Yeah, I'm hearing things that I think aren't there," or other things that might be signs of psychosis of one form or another. Can you talk about the best ways to respond, you know, not with that initial maybe fear or stigma, but with compassion in a way that's going to help somebody get help?
Right. I am so glad that you mentioned that, because responding in a way that shows compassion is one of the most important tools for helping people who are experiencing psychosis, so that the focus is really on understanding versus fixing, and really open connection building types of questions that show real genuine empathy and curiosity versus questions or statements that sound prescriptive or judgmental. And I think regardless of whether you have psychosis or not, everybody wants to be treated that way. I think the same rules apply to speaking to someone with psychosis as it would for anyone else experiencing distress. That connection, that empathy, the non-judgmental kinds of ways of speaking are just so incredibly important.
So we're going to call her. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So my question is, with like a psychosis brought on by something like PTSD from war or some other traumatic event, I have heard studies recently that they're talking about using psilocybin mushrooms, like magic mushrooms, to basically induce the psychosis to help resolve the original PTSD psychosis issue. And I guess I was just wondering the doctor's thoughts on that juxtaposition between using something that creates a psychosis to solve the psychosis.
Marcus, thanks for that call. Raquel, I feel like I've seen headlines about this again and again. Is there research going on that says this could be a positive step?
I have to say that I'm not aware of a lot of research that's been done in that area yet. Kind of like you said, there's certainly been a lot of headlines about it, but whether there's a strong evidence base behind that, it seems like the jury is still out, and that, you know, we need more research to really understand whether that can be beneficial for people in the long term.
Thanks for the call, Marcus. And Raquel, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, I'm delighted. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Raquel Meshulam-Gately, assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School, licensed clinical psychologist. She's director of neuropsychology research and the Consumer Advisory Board at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. We're talking about psychosis, the stigma around it, possible treatments, and coming up, we're going to hear about a support group and the Hearing Voices movement. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be talking about peer-to-peer support for psychosis. What do you want to know about that? Have you done that yourself? Call 800-642-1234. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about breaking the stigma surrounding schizophrenia and other conditions that can cause psychosis. A grassroots campaign called the Hearing Voices Movement is working to empower people who experience psychosis to talk about it openly and get support from their peers. The Hearing Voices Movement aims to validate the experiences of people with psychosis, provide coping mechanisms, and eliminate shame. Well, listen to some people who've taken part in the Hearing Voices Movement talk about their experiences. This is from a documentary called Beyond Possible, How the Hearing Voices Approach Transforms Lives.
My life changed dramatically because the voices that used to taunt me all the time, used to beat me up, they don't do that anymore. Because the simple fact I'm sharing my experience with other people, what I went through with my voices.
A big thing for me was knowing that I wasn't alone. Not being judged, a place that I could talk freely, not worrying about, am I going to end up in the hospital?
It's given me clarity, that's given me more stability, more confidence. I was shy, now I can speak out loud. It's really given me back my sense of self.
There's been limited research on the Hearing Voices approach, but some early research has shown promising signs. Cindy Hadge is lead trainer at the Wildflower Alliance, a group that offers peer-to-peer support for people who experience voices, visions, unusual beliefs, and extreme states. Cindy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I understand you've been a member of Hearing Voices support groups yourself. Can you share some of your personal experience and how it's worked for you?
Absolutely. I was at a point in my life where I was on Thorazine, and I was contemplating ending my life. I had tried very hard to use the traditional approaches to navigating the experience, and it really wasn't working for me. And I thought about peer support, because I had an experience with a 12-step peer support really helping me, and I just typed in mental health peer support, and I found out I lived within walking distance of one of the only groups at the time, the only Hearing Voices group in the United States. And in going to that group, instead of being a patient or mentally ill, people mirrored back strength to me. And I got to hear other people who are given the same diagnosis, and they were creating lives that they wanted to live. And in that moment, I thought, you know, maybe that's possible for me too.
Can you talk about what you talk about when you get together with people in a Hearing Voices support group?
Well, we have the freedom to talk about whatever we want to talk about. But for an example, at one time I had a huge fear, and it was making it hard to sleep at night. I kept having this fear that somebody would enter my apartment. And when I went to the group, I talked about the fear. They didn't say, oh, you're being silly, or don't worry. They asked me questions about the fear, and we narrowed it down to I had a fear that I would wake up to someone standing over my bed. And as a group, we brainstormed what to do. And I put pots and pans on my stairs so that I would be awake before, you know, anybody would be able to come in. And what happened was I was able to get sleep, you know, calm down. And I realized what had activated that fear in me, that I had seen a violent act outside my apartment that, you know, unconsciously reminded me of a time in my past where my experience was that I would wake up as a kid to somebody standing over my bed. So it was really neat to have people be curious about the context of my experience.
That sounds at root like really empowering. Like you and the other people in the group took charge and figured out brainstormed problems or solutions to your problem instead of somebody coming and solving it for you. How big a part of this peer-to-peer concept is that?
Well, it's truly about sharing experience, strength, and hope, and that people do develop strategies to deal for these unusual experiences, and they can learn from each other. Not that any one person has the right answer for somebody else, but to say there are options, there are things that I can do. They really encouraged me to become the expert of my experience. Like, when does that voice come? Does it come in relationship to anything? Have you gotten messages like that at another point in your life? How do you feel about those messages? Can you, you know, set kind of some kind of limits with those messages, with those voices? How do you understand them? How do you make meaning of them? And those are questions that I had not received in the traditional mental health system. You know, in the traditional system, I was simply told, we need to adjust your medication. That would be the response.
What do you wish people who don't experience these things, what do you wish that that they knew about what you go through and how you experience it?
Well, just, you know, you may not have ever had a voice yelling at you, but I bet you've had somebody yell at you, right?
Sure.
And so can you imagine how that feels? And so when somebody tells you, you know, I have a voice yelling at me, it's really not helpful to say, oh, just ignore it. It's not real. Instead, it might be helpful to say, that sounds really hard. I wouldn't like it if somebody was yelling at me. You know, those are the things that are helpful to acknowledge that even if you're not sharing the experience that person is having, they are really having that experience.
If somebody out there is listening right now and saying, wow, this is me or this is my loved one, how do people seek out this kind of peer-to-peer support experience?
And so they can definitely reach out to the Wildflower Alliance, and I'm hoping there's a way that you share our website. And there are lots of Hearing Voices groups all over the U.S., and we also have a number of family and friends groups. So people come in and they say, you know, I want to support my loved one, and we'll talk about, you know, how do they take care of their own selves? How do they deal with their own fear? You were talking about stigma earlier, and, you know, what do you, you know, a lot of times people, it's not the person hearing the voices that is in crisis. Sometimes it's the family member who's in crisis because they so much want to fix it, end it, cure it, solve it in a moment. And so anyways, family members need support too. And we encourage family members to actually show curiosity instead of fear and to show, you know, a faith in their loved one. You know, I believe in you. I love you. You know, I hope for good things for you versus I'm afraid of you and we got to get you to the hospital.
We've got a link up to a Dane County Hearing Voices support group at WPR.org/Central Time. We'll get one up there, by the way, for the Wildflower Alliance as well. We heard at the outset, Cindy, in that documentary, some people with, I think, amazing stories to share. What we heard your story. What do you hear from other people who have also joined peer-to-peer support about how it's changed the way they live their lives?
Because what's been really helpful, I think, for a lot of people is to find out they're not alone and that other people can navigate this and maybe they can too. That we, as I said earlier, we really shift the focus to, you know, what are your strengths and what do you want to do? And for once, you know, people aren't trying to tell other people what to do. It's more like, what would you like to do and how can we support you in that? And just building people up instead of marginalizing them with labels, and knowing that there's so many more tools to put in your toolbox than a psychiatric drug. You know, there's a place for that, or people get to decide how those work in your life. But there's also all these other things that you can do, some of which are clinical and some of them are, you know, peer support based.
And just our last half minute or so, Cindy, it seems like people have been more willing lately to talk about things like depression and anxiety. Are you hoping that for schizophrenia and other causes and symptoms of psychosis that people are going to be willing and feel safe to talk about it?
Well, first, I have to like challenge the question in that, you know, part of my recovery is getting as much distance from those words. Part of my recovery is getting distance from the diagnosis of schizophrenia, because that diagnosis comes with a horrible prognosis. You know, I was told, you know, you'll be on medication your whole life, you'll never be able to work, and I believed it for a while. Mm-hmm. And once I said, you know, maybe that's not true. You know, maybe it's trauma I need to heal, or maybe, you know, I have spiritual experiences, or I have gifts. So I had to change that framework to a framework that included recovery and hope and growth. Those particular frameworks do not hold much of that. And so they really kept me stuck.
Cindy, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your experience with us today.
Welcome.
That's Cindy Hatch, lead trainer at the Wildflower Alliance, a group that offers peer-to-peer support for people experiencing psychosis. For Wisconsinites interested in the resource, there is a Hearing Voices group in Madison. You can find a link to that group and to the Wildflower Alliance at WPR.org/Central Time.